This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 1st of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Following last week's London Design Festival special edition, we're staying on home ground, making the most of the design talent that was in the city for the event. Monocle editor Andrew Tuck caught up with Eve Bahar at the Monocle Cafe at the tail end of Design Week. They chatted about how good design and environmental concerns can go hand in hand.
There's always an opportunity with the products I work on to really help move along, you know, a cultural element or a societal element.
I met Peter Uni, founder of Cameron Peters Fine Lighting, about the Illuminous new addition to the London Design Week programme.
There are shows which are design shows, which are actually basically very dreary trade shows, and I'm sure we all know which they are. And then there's somewhere like this, which has a love and a passion.
And Monocle researcher Alexa Firmanich takes a stroll around the design studios of East London, courtesy of Mallorcan shoe company Camper.
We really love to work with and collaborate with different designers, and for us, what's really, really interesting is to have a design partnership which could be based on any different type of skill.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. London Design Festival officially ended the week before last, but the buzz of it still ticks along. Eve Bahar was in town during the event. He's the founder of San Francisco-based design agency Fuse Project. His was the team behind the world's first $100 laptop for the One Laptop Per Child scheme. They also helped to create Jawbone's wireless Jambox speaker, Herman Miller's Leaf Light, and most recently, a beverage carbonator for SodaStream, which aims to tackle our overconsumption of disposable soda bottles. Our editor Andrew Tuck met with Eve at the Monocle Cafe at the tail end of London Design Week.
It's amazing to launch SodaStream here in London, and we've done it a year ago with the first one, Source, and with the second one called Play, because people have so many memories. Everybody grew up here with here in London and England in general with a SodaStream, so you're really tapping into people's childhood memories, and that has been really fun to kind of hear everybody's stories about it. But the brand was, you know, really almost went away. And got revived in the last 4 or 5 years. And in a way, it's just at the intersection of two really important things today. One, which is this, I would say, internet application technology fueled state of mind that we're in today, which is this just-in-time notion, right? Just-in-time, taking a picture, sending it to a friend, or making a, you know, sending a letter via email, this notion that things can be done just now. And the other one, which is also very contemporary, is the do it yourself. And so between not having to plan for, you know, having to buy some bottles of, you know, bubbly water for tomorrow's kind of dinner party you have with your friends, being able to do it just in time then, and the idea that I'm going to make it myself, you know, that's a really important idea that people are relating to in a really, really big way today. The other one is, you know, sustainability, or at least sort of giving people the opportunity to consume in new ways simply by not having to throw bottles away every time they have a water or a soda is really important. You know, giving them the opportunity to do it, to achieve their own goals in that way, and to get rid of the silliness, really, of shipping fancy waters all the way across the world and putting them in the trash as soon as they're consumed. These two things are important today, and what that's, you know, SodaStream really gives people an option to do things differently.
I guess when, you know, SodaStream was invented all those years ago, it kind of did some of those things. But what's interesting is when you add somebody like yourself, well, when you add you, it becomes a product that people desire as well. So what's interesting, I guess, again, 20 years ago, maybe it was seen as a way of having cheap drinks because you couldn't perhaps afford the Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. But now that's not the case with it. You've managed to kind of reposition it in people's minds. So how much of that kind of, you know, that emotional element is important as well when you think about creating these products and how to kind of position it in people's psyche?
Well, for me, there's always an opportunity with the products I work on to really help move along, you know, a cultural element or a societal element. And there's certainly the desirability to have a beautiful object in your kitchen, you know, something that is designed to be so easy to use, you don't even have to think about it. And something that is designed also to be beautiful and architectural, you know, in your home environment. So I'm creating desire in a sense with design, but of things which I also think are important to, you know, to move people towards smarter solutions, more efficient solutions.
Do you think you're a designer in particular who believes that design can do good in the world? You've been involved with this project of the $100 laptop. Mm-hmm. Many of the products you make, they do have a kind of an understanding about sustainability. Mm-hmm. Is that a fundamental tenet of everything you do?
Whether it's implicit, whether it's you know, a part of the story, or whether it's not, sometimes it's just a, you know, more discrete version of that. I do think it's absolutely critical that designers see themselves as part of the whole world, not just a world of luxury or a world of consumption or a world of furniture, but whether, you know, the whole world around them. And so, you know, whether it's the clever little bag, you know, the new Puma, you know, shoebox, or whether it's the one laptop per child, I think there is a tremendous opportunity for us to, first of all, participate at a wider level. You know, have a conversation with the developing world, have a conversation at the mainstream supermarket level. I mean, it's important for us to be a part of those environments. And when we are, you know, doing things at a large scale, to have a level of consciousness and provide a level of consciousness for people who use and buy what we make.
Now, you're also involved with the Jawbone. You both mm-hmm. designed it, and you're part of the group of people who own that brand. Mm-hmm. What is the trick for a designer in, you know, you see the curve going ahead of where technology is heading. You've already discussed about that kind of instant element.
Sure.
But sometimes some of those things don't take off, or, you know, there's so many kind of paths you can go down with new technology that don't stick with us. Mm-hmm. Is there a risk for you when you're looking at all the opportunities that are being put in front of you? How did you select, say, the Jawbone and think, okay, this has got legs, this one will work?
Well, I had to change the business model many years ago because I simply wanted to do the best possible design work. And the best possible design work is done long term, is done with people you really understand well and you spend a lot of time with. And to me, that, you know, the business structure that we have created in order to have partnerships like this, was the impetus of this was really, how do I do the best design work? And what I realize is partnerships create the best design work. If I work on something for a year, 2 years, 5 years, and now 11 years, 12 years with Jawbone, it gets better every time. I'm the happiest, you know, with the mini Jambox, for example, that just launched. How do we select them? You know, there is a lot of opportunities. There is a lot of technologies. There's a lot of entrepreneurs out there. I mean, for my selection criteria is, you know, really about the quality of the people that are in front of me. It's what I've discovered with all these years, you know, a few successes and a bunch of failures, is it's how hard and how with it the CEO or, you know, the founders are going to stay, you know, how hard they're going to work to make something happen. They're going to have to pivot a few times, they're going to have to fail, they're going to have to live through rejection, they're going to have to live from, you know, through some successes, and you know, I want to work with people who are going to be just at it nonstop, where failure is not an option. And so that's a very important selection criteria. The other one is, obviously, you know, I want design to make a big difference, to create a lot of value for the companies I work with. And we all have to agree on that from the beginning.
Now, you set a very interesting kind of borderline between technology and design. Could you run your business today anywhere else than San Francisco?
That's a very good question. So I grew up in Europe. I grew up in Switzerland. I think that for me, moving to California 20 years ago really was a mind-opening experience. You know, I grew up in a place like Switzerland where change and what's new isn't the driving part of the culture. And then suddenly you're in Silicon Valley, in San Francisco, and people absolutely don't want to do the same thing that's been done before. They have zero interest in that. They all want to prove that there is a new way or a different way. You know, they all want to show that it's possible to achieve something through different means and new means. A lot of them are technological, obviously. But, you know, San Francisco has also had a tradition of completely new types of businesses before technology. You know, the sort of the gold rush, in a sense, is one that this notion of just going out there and trying something and taking risks is something that has been there for quite a long time. Technology is the latest iteration of it, but before that you had, you know, Levi's jeans, you had pioneering a new type of clothing. You know, you've had incredible entrepreneurs, you know, from that have always been there. I don't know if it's the air, I don't know if it's the fact that people come from a lot of different places, so there's a lot of varied perspective. You know, it's all very socially open. I mean, there's many reasons why it's a very special place where essentially ideas are, you know, what people want to hear, what they want to talk about, new ideas. And shoving aside the old ideas is a daily sport.
And your cultural heritage, you know, Turkish dad, East German mom, grew up in Switzerland. Are all those elements, you know, are they the sinews of what make you a designer as well?
I don't know that it turned me into a designer per se, because there was really no one in my family that had a design or artistic inkling. But it certainly has made me, from a very young age, just extremely curious about people. My design work starts with people and, you know, use case, like how people live, how they want to live, how what they aspire to. And in many ways, coming from these different cultures and seeing quite a different type of perspective on life in these different places, you know, has maybe sort of opened my mind about simply people and how different culturally and sometimes similar culturally we all are as well.
Yves Behar, founder of Fuse Projects, talking to our editor there, Andrew Tuck. HTC, the Taiwanese mobile telephone manufacturer, has fallen on hard times. Now, more than ever, the competition in the mobile telephone market is harsh. The juggernauts of Apple and Samsung are taking the lion's share of the market, which the still-fetid design of HTC, celebrated by many, is passing unloved and underused. So can the pioneering design behind the former success of the brand bring it back to the front of the race? Or has that ship sailed? Scott Croyle, Senior Vice President of Design for HTC, was in London for Design Week, over from their San Francisco office. He headed over to Midori House to catch up with Section D producer Aled John.
Let's start with your panel discussion at the London Design Festival. Give us a broad idea of what you were talking about.
Sure. Well, I mean, there were a group of five people. The topic was how to achieve meaningful innovation. So there was a couple of people that worked at corporations, BMW, HTC, and Microsoft, and then the guy who did user research, and then another woman who did design for molecular biology.
So obviously, a question that springs to mind, maybe it's a bit simplistic, is what is meaningful innovation?
I mean, I think it depends on the industry that you're talking about, but for HTC, when we work on phones or tablets, you know, whatever we're working on, you know, we look for stuff that's going to be meaningful in people's lives. So making sure that there's either a moment of delight, you know, something that kind of is like, oh, you know, that's a cool way of doing that, or something that people would just appreciate. So the industrial design on the HTC One, I think, is another good example of really striving for something that people can value, even if it's subconsciously, that they know that, you know what, that's an object that I'd like to have because it represents me in some way. It's an object I'd like to use because it's got some really cool, innovative features that are relevant to my life. I think a good example of that is Blink, Blink Feed on the home screen, which really brings content, you know, right to people's fingertips, and it can customize it around what they want that content to be, from their social networks to news articles or whatever.
That process of innovation, where does that begin in respect of the open source idea that the public should have an input into what's meaningful to them? How do you use those views, that input, in the process of innovation? Or do you put a product out to market and then gauge the response and then change it?
You know, I think it happens both ways. I think we typically have a vision of kind of what we think people might want, and that's usually based on kind of what we as consumers would want internally. So it's very much driven by, you know, we have a little bit of research, we're at least kind of following the trends that would happen on the market, but we use intuition really to kind of drive what we're going to move forward on. sometimes we might push something out kind of early to get some preliminary feedback, and then we might iterate on it. I think particularly with a product like Blink, it's going to be an evolving product because there's so much we can do with it. And so you can imagine that what we're doing now is really just the first stepping stone in terms of where it could go.
It's a really interesting and important area, obviously, for the telecommunications industry as a whole. But HTC, one might say as well, is facing very torrid times at the moment. The idea of where it's going to go, not just in terms of technology, but HTC is a company. It's a tough question to ask you to look into the crystal ball, but where do you see HTC in terms of design in the next couple of years?
You know, for HTC, it's obviously, we're definitely going through some tough times. I think the last 18 months have been a real challenge for us, as particularly two big competitors have come in with a lot of marketing dollars. And they're much bigger than us and have much further reach. So when we step back and kind of think about where we want to be in the market and how we're going to rethink our company, you know, we think about what we're really good at. What we're really good at is actually industrial design and then partnerships with our carriers and user experiences. So the design actually becomes the core of the way the whole company kind of pivots around. So I think over the next 2 or 3 years, I think you'll see HTC really double down on where our investments are. We'll see us continue to double down on design and really try to push that even further forward. Services are becoming a much bigger part of the user experiences. The general UI on phones have kind of reached a point, at least in the Android space, where they've gotten a lot better. And so the services become more and more important in terms of how we execute those services and make them interesting to people.
You as Vice President of Design at HTC, do you see design to be the answer to HTC's woes?
You know, I think it's one puzzle piece, a rather large puzzle piece, at which we kind of pivot the whole company around.
I ask because HTC has always had a really good reputation for design. It's always been a good example of great mobile phone design. And how much more can design contribute to solving the problem for HTC?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think, you know, from the time I joined HTC, which was when HTC acquired a design firm in San Francisco, I was part of that design firm about 6 years ago. I think at that point, we realized that design could be a way for the company to pivot around a certain either attribute or a feature or a trait. You know, going forward, there's obviously a limit of how far that can go when there's so much marketing dollars are being pumped into the marketplace. But I have to say that I think that HTC is still putting out what is called the best phone in the market. I mean, HTC One is still recognized as being the best smartphone in the market. And, you know, without that, we would really be nowhere, actually. So even though the times are challenging, we've actually established ourselves with a strong foothold in that market, being known for design. And, you know, without it, we really would have nothing. So as we kind of look forward and we look to evolve our strategy, it has to be based off of kind of who we are as people and the culture of the company. And it's so much driven around the design team and the user experience team that'll continue to be the case. I think we'll look at having some other pillars that complement that. And we'll be talking about those, you know, in the near future. But
maybe some marketing dollars as well.
Yeah. Could always use marketing dollars.
Yeah, we can all use them. Design is obviously a very important thing for HTC. You mentioned there that your company has some big traits, some big features. Which ones stand out for you as the kind of symbols of HTC's emblem of good design?
Sure. So I think if we go back to the HTC One and the One Mini, which have both launched this year, kind of our part of our flagship line. The HTC One, I think let's start off with the industrial design. I think the first thing to note about it is that it's got an all-metal construction, which was a big breakthrough in the industry. You know, if you look at most phones, even if there's metal, they'll either have glass or plastic over where the antennas typically are. So the HTC One really kind of takes that to the next level. And on top of that, we also developed this zero-gap construction, which means that the fit and finish is really perfect. And we really feel like, in terms of industrial design, it's really executed at kind of a very superior level. I think one of the other features on the HTC One is boom sound, which is the dual front-facing speakers. I think there were a lot of questions of whether we could make it fit in, but you know, I think we had all been in those moments where you're at a bar or you're at a party with a friend, and you're actually trying to show them some video on YouTube or Vimeo, and everybody's trying to gather around trying to hear it, yeah. And it just kind of made sense when the idea came up, like, oh yeah, of course, that would be great if we could put that in. So I think it's emblematic of kind of the way we think and kind of where these kind of little kernels come from. I think in terms of the user experience, I think there's a couple of key features. Number one is Blink, which I already talked about a little bit, but I think also there's been a lot of investment in the camera and those experiences. I think in particular, one of the features that I really love is the highlight movies. What it does is it takes your photos and your videos, and it basically automatically puts together a 30-second clip. And then you can go back and remix it. And it does it all on the fly. So you can remix it. You can add, you know, you can add a music track to it and actually have this, not just a photo that you're sharing with people that maybe you've run through some effect, but a whole movie that really captures a lot more than just a photo. In fact, you know, if a photo captures 1,000 words, what is a video capture? You know, it captures kind of an infinite amount, even just in a little 3-second clip.
I wonder, it's a Taiwanese company, but where's the spiritual home for HTC? Is it in America? Where do you see the most rapturous reception to the design or the new designs that come out? Is your target market Asia or is it the West?
I think that HTC is a global company, and I think without a doubt it does well in Taiwan. And I think just because of, if you talk to the Taiwanese, this is their crown jewel. It really is a great success story out of Taiwan. Having said that, I think the markets really to be relevant that we have to be relevant in are Europe. UK is very strong for us. Germany is also very strong for us. So we have, I think in terms of the top two markets in Europe, we're actually doing very well. And then the United States is another key market. A lot of the innovation, if it's not successful in the United States, it's really not gonna make traction just culturally in the rest of the world. And so that's key. And I think as you look over the next 3 or 4 years, obviously China is a big growing market. So there's a lot of opportunity there. We're just kind of dipping our toe in and kind of getting started there, but we think there's a lot of opportunity for us.
What does the short-term future hold for HTC? Which challenges lie ahead for you? What are you really looking forward to as VP of design? Are you given kind of a blank canvas, say, here's your budget, go off, create kind of thing?
In the short term for the company, I think the first thing to do is figure out what's wrong with the company and then start working on an execution strategy and actually develop and articulate a clear strategy to both the market and our employees. And that's already in process. And so I'm actually pretty excited about moving forward over the next, you know, 3 to 6 months, because I think you'll see some traction and some good news kind of coming within a 6-month period around that. In terms of design, there's a couple of things that we're working on that I'm super, super excited about. Things that could actually move beyond just the phone and create a real opportunity for HTC. And so I'm really excited about kind of what that could mean for HTC and you know, how we as a company kind of can learn and grow from that exercise.
Scott Croyle, Senior VP of Design at HTC, talking to Section D producer Aled John there. Coming up, I chat with Sam Barron of Fabrica to talk about its carpet collaboration with Taiping.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris. The parquet floors of Midori House's ground floor were virtually recarpeted during London Design Festival when Italian design studio Fabrica presented its collaboration with Chinese luxe carpet manufacturer Taiping. The collection saw everything from a green dog's house to picture frames made out of the company's fine materials. Just shy of a dozen of Fabrica's designers played out their wildest carpet fantasies. I caught up with Fabrica Design Department Director Sam Barron to discuss the collection in the Monocle studio just next door.
It starts for Designers' Day in Paris, which is this event occurring once a year during a week. All the showrooms are opening doors and they have to do a specific presentation. So either it can be only a layout, which is different, either they launch a new product, either they just make a proposal which supposedly should blow up visitors. And every year there is thematic. I did 2 years ago one with Sèvres porcelain, which won a prize, so it was quite successful for everybody. And then last year I get a call from Taiping that was looking for someone to drive creativity for their next presentation. And the thematic was, what about tomorrow? So I was really oriented about the future, about research, about bringing new visions. As I'm creative director of the design studio in Fabrica, I say, wow, this is perfect wedding, because you are this big brand, you have a big presence in France in your beautiful headquarters, and we as Fabrica can bring you a completely new vision of what is a carpet. I just put a condition, which was like, please don't expect a carpet. Because if you just want a like 2D beautiful graphic design or something that can be translated in wool, but still a 2D application, maybe, you know, we can do it, but maybe you can also call a very good graphic designer. And if you really want to make a step forward, then in this case, maybe you should expect something else. Maybe it could be a chandelier made of wool, and the same weight of the chandelier is exactly the weight of a carpet that should be there. So something like this. And they were like, oh, yeah. Yeah, okay, let's go forward. So that's the way. We were challenging a bit the brand, we were challenging the production capacities, and we were also challenging ourselves, because except myself, none of my designers never designed a carpet. So it was something also quite new for everybody.
And they all reacted to it in very different ways, didn't they? I mean, all the sort of the multi-disciplines they have at Fabrica and the sort of the end results through there are quite diverse. Could you sort of describe some of the products that your designers have ended up doing?
Yeah, the idea was that the Fabrica spirit, which is really this interaction between talents, even if they come from different part of the world, even if they have different religion, way of living, culture, etc., all team up thanks to creative inputs, and everybody has to give his own answer. Still, it has to be a collection, so everybody has to kind of fit with the other one. But my idea was like, okay, we're going to do 10 pieces. Everybody has his own blank page and can really present himself as a designer. So it was quite open. And yes, from an illustrator to graphic designer to a product designer or an architect, of course, the answers are different in terms of shapes and functionalities, but also very different in terms of style and taste, because everybody was really assuming his personality through working with wool and silk. You have like a trunk, which is a roll carpet where people can sit. So it was the work of an architect that didn't fold the carpet as a decorative surface, but the carpet as volume in the space. Mm. So he did this trunk. You have empty frames, which are much more graphic application. So it's like designing the line that go around the carpet. Basically, with a line, you define the superficie, the surface of a carpet on the floor. And if you take this line as something more conceptual, basically this line become a frame. So we have also this collection of frames.
Yeah.
Then we have something which is much more based on illustration and also based on a souvenir from China, because we went to see the manufacturer in China. Mm. And you have the workers, when they do huge carpet, they have to put scaffolding and small benches to sit there and work. And they do these very simple, humble benches. And to make them more comfortable, they use some samples of carpets. So the girl that saw this image, she decided to redesign the bench to pay homage to the workforce of the manufacturer and apply lots of her existing and specially made illustration to compose this patchwork that are the cushions of the benches.
Let's talk about the sort of the manufacturing process. I mean, I know the craftsmen that Taiping have working for them are incredibly skilled. The green carpet doghouse in particular, and which is made up of loads and loads of sort of pixel squares of carpet, which is all sort of hand cut, weren't they?
Basically, they can do anything. Whatever you dream as a carpet, they make it happen. They control the entire process, which is also something very amazing.
Yeah.
So they receive the raw wool, they start to work it. Then you can choose exactly the color you want, and then they do your color. And then there is a thousand ways of working the wool, the silk, mixing both of them. You can also have a carpet made of rope, made of plastic fibers. And so there is amazing quantity of techniques of how to design a carpet. And for us, it was quite fun and also a bit over the top, because when you have so much possibilities, you know, it's like, wow, it's Disneyland here. We can do everything we want. The Chinese people really want you to love the way they work. And it has been an amazing week there, because we were eating with them in the canteen. We are like sharing the working hours with them, visiting every single corner of the company. And you have a school there, and they teach how the people can curve. They are ranking the people also to know the best curving person. And yeah, we have this doghouse, which has been made by a Lebanon designer, David Raful. And it's all about greens and inside and outside. And all the superficie of the house is made of this, as you say, pixelized grass, which is small pyramids made of wool, and everything has been carved by hand, and they are all similar, even if they are gradients, so higher and lower. So it's just like something that you think, there is only a machine that can do this. But no, to have this amazing feeling, this way of receiving the light and also comfort capacities, it has to be made by hand.
So. Yeah. Does China's Chinese craft sort of get a bad rap, would you say, having experienced it firsthand?
What I think is that they are incredibly skilled. They know exactly what they do. They can make everything happen in an amount of time which is completely crazy, because normally it takes quite a long time to make a carpet, and they were so excited by the project that everybody was like putting so much energy and really like lots of faith in producing these pieces. It was really funny. I think that the fact of us being completely strangers, not just in terms of color, skin, and culture, but also being strangers from Taiping. We were not member of the brand, but we were like really special guests. Was also very exciting for them, because they were receiving ambassadors or something that they didn't know what was it, which is Fabrica. And it was really funny, because my first conversation with the workforce team was really to present them the project, to explain them what we're going to ask, what we were looking for. And we were waiting for them to give us a feedback of, technically speaking, how they can do this, or if it's possible. If it's not possible, there is a plan B, there is another solution. And if something was possible, there is maybe another solution or another way to make it, which is much more interesting, or which is something new that they just try. So it was really like trying to put everybody on board and and going very far away. And imagine myself, which I don't speak Cantonese, and I had to describe all this project and make them believe in it. So you ask how you say dog, you ask how you say house, and you say dog house, and you show these crazy drawings. And yeah, and everybody smile, and then the magic happened.
And what's the reaction been like so far?
Very good. Yeah, the show in Paris went really well. And here in Midori House, it seems that also public is really responsive. Should go to Hong Kong and eventually New York later next year.
Sam Baron of Fabrica there. At London Design Festival, Section D donned our headphones and microphones to broadcast from Design Junction, one of the week's most exciting trade shows. We also packed our sunglasses, as this year's edition took on a brighter guise than usual with the debut of Light Junction. It's London's first trade show dedicated to fine lighting and was created by Peter Uni. He's the founder of Cameron Peters Fine Lighting, billed as the world's only consultancy dedicated to quality decorative lighting. I caught up with Peter at the opening.
I know no other show like it that has this amazing... Well, buzz is the only word I can think of. There are shows which are design shows, which are actually basically very dreary trade shows, and I'm sure we all know which they are. And then there's somewhere like this, which has a love and a passion, both from some of the people who are exhibiting, choice of people, but also from the visitors, the sort of people that it attracts.
Yeah, and also the place as well. I mean, it's quite an... extraordinary place to hold a trade fair.
It is, and one of the most important things is location.
Yeah.
And what better location could there be than right here in the heart of London, just north of Covent Garden near Bloomsbury? We know that a lot of designers, interior designers, who are our target market, if they go to, they'll probably only go to one place during this whole week. They're going to come here because of the quality of the exhibitors, but frankly also because of where it is.
So tell us about your sort of quite unique involvement with this year's Design Junction.
What we do generally is unique. We're the only consultancy in the world that exists solely to help interior designers specify fine lighting. It's a complicated field. We know more than anybody else does about it in the world, solely because we're the only people who've specialised in it. We therefore know who the designers should be aware of. We know the brands that they should be aware of. But how do you get the designer and the brand together? It's very difficult. So by doing Light Junction, which is part of Design Junction, we bring the people who make the lights and design the lights here and some of their lights, and then put them together with the designers. Because we know that our main aim, which is to get good light specified, needs this.
And this is Light Junction's first sort of outing, as it were. Why has it happened now?
it takes an idea a time for ideas to crystallize. We had the finest lighting showrooms in the world. All the manufacturers used to come and they would confirm this. But actually there was very little interest in seeing lighting showrooms. So we had to find some other way of enabling people to see a real light. It's as simple as that. If you've only seen pictures, there's no lighting showrooms, shops in London, there's virtually no coverage in magazines. So we had to do something. And it took a while, a period of gestation, but also visiting the various shows this time last year and talking to the organizers of this one, of Clark and Well, of 100% and things like that. So the whole concept had to come together. We knew what we wanted to do, but we don't run shows. So we had to find the show that we would combine with.
I mean, this show feels very sort of, you know, very London, but who are you expecting to see here? I mean, there's a big sort of international crowd that comes to Design Junction, isn't there, in particular?
We know exactly who we're expecting to see, because what people will say, organizers say, oh, we had 35% interior designers. And we said, well, let's see the names. And we haven't heard of any of them.
Yeah.
Because we know the interior designers by name, where they work and name of their dog and all the rest of it, we were able to send out various mailings and talk to people. And so we have asked specific individuals. So we hope to see them all here, because we've tried to make it as effective for them as possible, not just by this show, but by arranging three training sessions of things they need to know about.
So, oh, really?
So uniquely, unlike any normal fair organizer, we know exactly who we want to see, and they're the people from the top London-based studios on the whole.
So the shows like this are really sort of built to enable and help the designers who are showing there, of, you know, whether they're emerging or established, would you say?
It's a great showroom. People have got a new design, can put it out in front of people. There is a major problem, though, and that is that there are lights being shown here which are illegal and potentially dangerous. There are people showing lights that have not been certified. You have to wonder why you would create a company and spend money developing a product and then showing it if you can't sell it. And people should stop and think about, say, the scandal that surrounded the Best implants. If you sell things that are illegal and potentially dangerous, terrible things are going to happen. So there are a number of issues, but at least it gets people out there. They can gauge the response and decide whether they should spend more money on it. Everybody does it. Floss will do it with the Philippe Starck design. They'll put it up and just see whether people are interested, what sort of price they would pay. So it's like busking. You go out there and you get a genuine response from people, which is the most invaluable thing of all for young designers.
Yeah.
There are two young designers here who, their entire line, a very well-known, very high-end company, wanted to buy the whole collection this time last year.
Wow.
And there's no other way those two things would have come together if it hadn't been for this show last year. It's very exciting.
What else are you excited about for the rest of the week, besides Design Junction?
What we have in place now is going to be exciting all week. And because we're here all the time, for the first time ever, we won't get to see what else is happening. I would love to go out to Moy's showrooms, because they were showing in the Zona Tortona in Milan, and there was no other reason to go there this year, so we missed it. So there's one or two things around town, but sadly we're not going to see them. If people are coming to one show, this is where they should come. The highest standard of stand and, by goodness, the best fun.
Peter Uni of Cameron Peters Fine Lighting there, talking to me at London's Design Junction. Coming up, Alexa Firminich joins Mallorcan shoe brand Camper for a design tour of London's Shoreditch.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly programme on the best in design, architecture, graphics and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris. During the London Design Festival, every nook and cranny of the city is immersed in fresh and exciting design ideas, all bustling to be noticed and discovered. The Shoreditch Design Triangle in the east of London is specially organised to bring together a collection of different designers, stores, galleries and studios in this heartland of the city's creative industry. This year, for the first time, Mallorcan footwear brand Camper partnered with Decenio to launch a design walk around Shoreditch. It aimed to showcase the best of what the area has to offer and provide a rare peek into different designers' studios. Monocle's Alexa Firminich took a stroll to check it out.
You wouldn't believe this used to be a plumber's shop. Our small group is standing inside a minimalist space with whitewashed walls, which, from the inside, could be the interiors of any chic office in the centre of town. However, we're actually up in northeast London, away from the hustle and bustle of the city's other creative districts. Or so I thought. As I learn on this design walk, many studios have been moving into this part of town to set up shop.
It's very busy and a lot of people see us.
That's Joanna Agerman-Ross, founder of Desenio magazine. She's leading the troops on this first leg of the tour, describing their newly redesigned office on Kingsland Road and how it represents what Desenio are all about. Functional, simple, and stylish design. Joanna had always dreamed of having her floors decked out by Denison, and this was the perfect opportunity to try it out. The result being an entire room filled with heart oak oiled flooring and the brand's signature butterfly clips holding together the irregular planks. The room feels light, airy, and at a communal table in the middle sits her team tapping away on Mac computers.
I started thinking that Denison, a Danish flooring company,
as we try to escape a very British downpour, a half-soaked Catherine Denby from Camper describes how the shoe brand became so involved in the design world.
This is the first ever design walk, but as a brand, we always had a really great affinity and love design. We work with lots of different designers, and actually, as a brand, we also truly love walking. I mean, a long time ago, the brand was really associated with walking, so it kind of made sense to us. We thought that it would be good to link up with Desenio and do a design walk.
Why Desenio?
Joanna, their editor, we worked with her closely before, and they have a really great knowledge of London and a really, really lovely, beautiful magazine connected with loads of different designers, actually, who we work really closely with. So it seemed like a natural affinity for us to work together.
So which stops and studios are we going to be seeing along the way?
So today we're going to go and see Rolly, who's designed a very special keyboard for us. We're going to go see Doshi Levian, who of course designed the Spitalfields store and has designed a number of other stores for us already. They're like a London design duo who have produced some really interesting work for brands like Haagen-Dazs and various different people. We're also going to go to see Benedict Radcliffe, and I'm really looking forward to that. He's created a skateboard rink. It's really beautiful, based a beautiful design, but really, really functional as well. And then we're going to end up at the Camper store.
Maybe you could describe the design of your new store. Is it similar to your other stores?
Okay, so we have over 350 stores in the world. And actually, we kind of pride ourselves that every store is really quite unique. It makes it more complicated for us, but for our customers, we think that is really inspirational. So the design of this store in Spitalfields by Doshi Levian is based on Indian summers. So the designers created a space which was like a treat for the eye that was designed to reflect like sweets and summer days and happy times. And actually, of all of the spaces that we create, we always try to have this little mixture between design, functional use, because obviously at the end of the day we need to have somewhere to put the shoes, but it always has a very camper spirit, which is a very Mediterranean, laid back, kind of natural spirit. And normally the designers kind of incorporate that into their design, and we end up with such a variety, it's beautiful.
And there's also an interplay between the designers and the products themselves, the shoes. I understand you're collaborating with Doshi Levian on some shoes as well.
That's right. We work with them in the summer to create some very special shoes. We work with several designers. We ask them to take maybe some of the shoes that we've designed in the past and to consider how they would interpret them. And so Nipa and Jonathan took some of our twins' range of shoes and created their very special twin shoes, a sandal for women and like a black brogue for men. The twin shoes are basically non-identical twins. So each shoe is an individual. So we have lots of different interesting kind of things that come as a result of that.
Do you think there's a larger interplay between shoes as a type of object and fashion object than maybe other types of clothes?
Sure. So at Camper, we really love to work with and collaborate with different designers. And for us, what's really, really interesting is to have a design partnership which could be based on any different type of skill. So it might not be a fashion designer that we're working with. It could be like an industrial architect or an interior designer. And the reason is that actually when you think about the production of a shoe, It's actually a 3D object, and it combines leather, it combines PVC or rubber or wood, and all of these things have to go into this production to make this 3D object work together and be comfortable. So actually working with these kind of designers makes total sense.
We've arrived at a small, narrow side alley. At first sight, it looks like we might be lost, and I wonder what we're doing here. But then I realize that this is just one of the Design Walk's many surprises. Pushing aside a heavy steel door, we enter a large design studio replete with long wooden benches and arching ceilings. Welcome to the home of Raleigh, the company behind a futuristic electric keyboard released earlier this year, the Seaboard.
And then in here, come on in, gather around.
We're being ushered into a room where technicians are bent over workbenches, molding silicon onto metallic keyboard frames. It really does feel like we've walked into a scene from a science fiction movie.
So this is the tech hive. So this is where a lot of the prototyping happens, with the silicon casting and also with some of the other elements of the Seaboard creation, more that we used to do. Now there's more down at the arches, so assembly and that kind of thing. But there are lots of different sort of processes going on here with silicon and with prototyping and with using different molds and that kind of thing. So that's what happens in this part. And then back there is more silicon related. We call that Silicon Alley. back
there. Roland Lam is the man behind the machine.
The Seaboard is an instrument that's based on the piano keyboard, but it allows the musician to modulate the sound of each note in real time. So instead of just playing a note and then waiting for a moment and playing another note, you can push into this soft, continuous material and bend the pitch of the note and modulate the timbre of the note.
Despite being an avid piano player, Roland was always slightly frustrated with the instrument. With a guitar or a violin, you can bend and bring expression to the pitch of a note. But with a piano, well... not as much. Unless you play the Seaboard, that is. At first, it looks exactly just like a piano. But, as you can hear, the sound has been completely transformed. Different levels of pressure onto the silicon keys curve the sound of the instrument. You can go louder, or softer. Roland shows us how to press the keys to curve the pitch of the note and keep changing its volume. As we leave Raleigh's studio, I begin wondering just how many hidden artists and designers there actually are in the area, behind the deceiving rundown facades of these many buildings. For Monocle, in London, I'm Alexa Firmanish.
And that's all for this week's Section D. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on Section D. I'm Tom Morris. To play us out today, here's 50 Words for Snow by Kate Bush, featuring the dulcet tones of Stephen Fry. Thanks for tuning in. Bye-bye.